Johns Hopkins brain scientist David Linden delves deep into the sense of touch, from why we can't tickle ourselves to how our body distinguishes between pain and pleasure. David Linden wonders why mint feels cool on the tongue while chili peppers feel hot, or how long it takes for the pain of a stubbed toe to reach the brain. And what's the point of fingerprints anyway? Touch is an intensely emotional sense, David Linden says. A shoulder rub from a friend feels very different from one from a domineering boss. And touch can influence how we perceive others. If you're looking at someone while holding a warm cup of coffee, you're apt to consider that person more trustworthy. Lots to explore, head to toe with David Linden on Midday, after the news from NPR. Hey, welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Now imagine this, you reach into a purse or your backpack looking for a dime. Without looking, you sort through the items in your bag, including nickels and pennies, you know what those feel like, and you find exactly what you're looking for. How do you do that? How are we able to do this? How much communication is occurring between your fingertips and your brain during that little process, very common process? Here's another scenario. You're interviewing a candidate for a job, and it's a morning interview, in your hands a warm cup of coffee. Does that influence how you feel about the candidate sitting across from you? And what if the coffee were iced instead? Would that change how you felt? Has watching someone else scratch ever made you feel itchy? Have you ever had sympathetic pains after watching someone else get hurt? Our sense of touch affects more than just how we physically interact with the world. It is inextricably linked to emotional and linguistic regions of our brains. That's why a broken heart can actually feel painful. In this hour, we're going to explore our sense of touch from head to toe with Johns Hopkins neuroscientist David Linden. He's a brain researcher and a self-proclaimed fanboy of touch research. His other books include The Accidental Mind and the New York Times bestseller, The Compass of Pleasure, which marked the last time David was on Midday with me. He is also the former editor-in-chief of the Journal of Neurophysiology. The new book is called Touch, The Science of the Hand, Heart, and Mind. It's published by Viking just out within the last couple of months. David Linden calls touch the one sense that is essential to human development. Infants who are touch-deprived face developmental delays and more likely experience emotional problems and illnesses. Touch is a social sense. It can bond us. Parents bond with their children. Basketball players use touch to develop a sense of loyalty among teammates. And, of course, romantic partners communicate affection and love through lots of touch. Touch is also linguistic. It is no accident that we say we had a rough day or that we call someone a softy. Those words evoke a commonly understood feeling. Our sense of touch is weird and wonderful, and while scientists have studied long and hard, there are still mysteries to be explored. Why do our fingers get pruny during a long bath? Can prosthetic limbs signal texture and temperature to the brain? How can we distinguish greasy from sticky? How do we do that? And why does mint feel cool on the tongue anyway? David Linden, welcome to Midday. It's nice to have you back on the show again.
Thanks for having me on again.
So many interesting questions. So how did you become a fanboy of touch research?
Well, there's two reasons. First of all is I'm always looking for a topic that I think is central to our human experience, and touch is that. And the other reason is that it just so happens that Johns Hopkins University, where I work, is a world center of touch research. And so I ate lunch every day for years with some of the leaders in this field, and they would talk about what they were doing, and I became very excited about it.
So it's all around us. It's all around you, the touch research. So that's one thing. But, of course, touch is something we experience all the time without really thinking about it.
Well, it's true. We have a way of taking it for granted, and I think the reason is because it's an always-on sense. We can't imagine it being gone. If we're sighted and we close our eyes, we can kind of imagine what it's like to be blind, and you can, pinch your nose shut or plug your ears. But you can't turn off your touch sense. And I think that's the reason why we tend to take it for granted.
Steve Jobs, of course, thought the world was all about touch in Apple, right? He thought everything was going to be about touch.
Well, not only did he think that, but in the post-Jobs era, they're now creating tactile feedback trackpads. So the very newest iteration of Macintosh laptops, the trackpad will actually vibrate back at you.
And why? What's going on there? What are they trying to get at?
Well, they're trying to use tactile cueing as a way of knowing, as a way of giving you a sense of when you've manipulated your cursor over a particular kind of object on the page.
But so you're developing some memory there of it?
Well, you are. You're developing a different kind of cue. And I think what's interesting is not to think of it so much in this present, very crude iteration, but imagine in the future when you're shopping, right? A lot of people, when they buy something like clothes, they want to touch it, you know? What does that fabric feel like? That leather wallet, is that really good quality? Does it feel nice and buttery like good leather, or is it kind of cheap and shoddy? So in the future, when you have your, whatever it is, your iPhone 12 with a super enhanced haptic display, and you're shopping at your online retailer, they will be able to display the texture of an object through a little pad that you will be able to touch and explore.
I look forward to that. Can we go over some of the things that I mentioned in the introduction of this show?
Please.
Because I'm really intrigued myself. So reaching into a bag, a crowded or cluttered backpack looking for a dime, you need a dime.
Yeah.
I just use the word memory. I have memory of what that dime feels like, right?
You do, and you need special sensors in your fingers to be able to resolve the properties that allow you to distinguish a dime from a nickel or a quarter. And if we were to look under a microscope at the nerve endings in the skin of your fingertip, we would find all kinds of different ones. There's specialized ones for hot and cold and pain and itch. And then there are specialized ones for different aspects of mechanical sensation. So there's one called a Merkel ending that's really good for determining fine tactile form. That would be what would allow you to feel the ridges on the edge of the dime, for example, or to feel the embossed surface of the face of the coin.
Is that named after someone? Merkel?
Merkel was a 19th century German anatomist. All these endings are named after 19th century anatomists, and they're called Merkel, Meissner, Piccinian, and Ruffini. I know, it sounds like a law firm, but they're actually scientists.
So they studied touch.
They studied touch, and they identified the different kinds of nerve endings.
Mm-hmm.
So you need that Merkel in order to recognize the fine form on the coin. But then you go to pull it out of your pocket, say you want to put it in a parking meter, right? You are gripping it subconsciously. You have a reflex that allows you to grip it with just the right amount of pressure. You want to use just enough pressure so it doesn't fall out of your fingers and fall on the floor, but not so much pressure that you're exerting your maximal crushing force of your muscles, which is not necessary. It's particularly important if you're holding a child's hand or an egg or something like that.
Right.
So how do you do that? Well, there's a different nerve ending called a Meissner that's sensitive to microscopic slips between your finger and objects. So when you pick up that dime, at first you're using not enough force, and it is slipping out of your fingers very, very slightly, just on the level of thousandths of a millimeter. But your Meissner endings detect that, and then there's a reflex. You don't have to think about it. Those signals go from your Meissner endings in your fingertips, they go to your spinal cord, and they go back out to the muscles in your fingers and have you pinch slightly tighter so that you are now, you go through several iterations of that just in a fraction of a second, so you're now gripping the coin with the precisely correct amount of force.
We are incredible.
We are.
Human,
we're so cool.
The human body is amazing.
And what's even better is that we don't even have to think about it.
No.
Most of what's happening in the brain is happening subconsciously.
Right. Fingerprints. So that's following right along here. That question came up, what is the point of fingerprints anyway, besides criminal forensics? They come in handy, but they're there to help us with that grip, and all those endings that you were just describing find their way into those into those prints at the end of our fingers or not?
Well, it turns out that if you look at the fingerprints, and, you know, under a microscope, they'd be ridges and canyons up and down.
Right.
And yes, there are certain kinds of endings that are in the troughs, and some of them are in the peaks there. Nonetheless, we don't entirely know what fingerprints are for. Some people have claimed that they're there to help us detect high-frequency vibrations when we scan a finger across a surface. Other people say, no, that's not true. Evolutionarily, fingerprints are really interesting because we share them with great apes. But if you look down the evolutionary tree, for example, koalas have fingerprints, but a very close relative of the koala called the hairy-nosed wombat doesn't have fingerprints. And it's not like they live that differently. It's not like they use their hands and their fingers in a way where it would be obvious where you would say, oh, okay, the koala's got to have it because of X. So it's still a little bit of a mystery.
How about hair? Can we talk about hair for a minute?
Let's do.
Some of us have a lot of hair. Some of us don't have as much hair. There's hair. We think there's hair in certain places where there's not hair, or there's we think there's not hair when there's actually is hair. There's all kinds of different depths or densities of hair, and
it turns out that there are only a few parts of the skin that have no hair at all that we call hairless or glabrous skin, and these are the palms of our hands, the soles of our feet, our lips, nipples, part but not all of the genitals. So there are really only a few places that we think of as being hairless, like, you know, Keira Knightley's cheek, for example. If you were to look carefully, there'd be tiny little what we call vellus hairs there. But it turns out that these hairy and hairless kinds of skin have very different functions. The hairy skin has a special ending that wraps around the base of the hair follicle. It detects hair deflection, and it's remarkably a specialized caress sensor. It's called a C-tactile nerve fiber, and it's there to detect the kind of caress that we would have in loving touch.
Speaking of loving touch, I've never been in the presence of baboons except maybe in a zoo, okay? But, but I've seen film of baboons who seem to spend a lot of time touching each other, grooming each other, maybe beyond what's necessary. In humans, I mean, we do some of that, right, among people that we're intimate with. But
well, absolutely. The way that you're right that baboons and other non-human primates that live in large social groups, like bonobos as well, spend a lot of time grooming, and they spend more than they need just to keep the fur clean and free of insects and twigs. And they do it in order to form social bonds. So the people you groom with, they're your allies. They're your buddies. They're the ones you're going to run to in a fight. They're the ones you're going to protect. If there's a leopard coming through the bush, they're the ones you will emit a call to warn them, even though the leopard might then come after you. So just in the same way as basketball players, you know, pat each other on the rear end and high five and chest bump in order to build trust and cooperation, the baboons are doing the same thing when they're grooming each other.
Do humans, Americans, let's talk about cultural differences. I'm curious about this. Do Americans touch each other as much as people in other countries do? Did you look into that?
Well, I didn't look into that, but years ago, a guy named Sidney Gerard liked to spy on people in cafes, and he went around the world, and he would look not just at romantic couples, but at friends and business associates, and in San Juan, Puerto Rico, people would touch each other on the average 170 times an hour, and in Baltimore, it might be 30 times an hour, and in Paris, 40 times an hour, and in London, 0 times an hour.
What is that about? Social norms?
It is about social norms, and we know that even if you were just to go around in Baltimore and go in different communities, you would find very different ideas about what is appropriate interpersonal touching, particularly between the sexes.
Let's talk a little bit about human development and touching, because you spent a lot of time on this. Infants, children, the motherly touch, the fatherly touch, the parental touch. You say it's vital to healthy human development, touch.
That's right. So you can be born blind, and you can grow up great. Your mind will be fine. Your body will be fine. Same if you're born deaf. You can have a terrific life. Everything works. But if you're born with a sense of touch, but you don't receive loving touch as a baby, and we know this from the Romanian orphanages in the Ceausescu regime, and shortly thereafter, mm-hmm. where they were grossly understaffed, and basically these kids were in touch for the first 2 years of their lives.
They were feral,
and it was a disaster. So they had compulsive rocking, self-soothing motions that would emerge, and they had attachment disorders, cognitive delays, and it wasn't just mental problems. They had problems with their bodies. The immune system doesn't develop properly. The gastrointestinal system doesn't develop properly. And if the intervention doesn't come in the first 2 years, these problems will be carried throughout life. So touch, unlike the other senses, touch is not optional for early human development.
So if someone says, you know, my mother didn't hug me enough, my father didn't hug me enough, that could be a very real thing and not just some excuse they're making.
It could be a real thing. I think the thing to realize is that most parents do a perfectly fine job in giving their kids social touch. It's not like you need to go overboard. It's the same thing with these crazy baby Mozart CDs and, you know,
right.
motorized mobiles and all these things that parents like to buy and which are marketed to them very heavily. You don't need that stuff. Normal human interaction is just fine. You don't need to give your baby 2 hours of massage every day for it to grow up to be bonded to you. That said, appropriate social touch throughout life is a great thing. It makes people more confident, it reduces depression, it reduces anxiety, and it reduces the incidence of chronic pain and a number of inflammatory diseases.
One last thing about parents there. There may be some parents who just are unable to provide as much touch as other parents because they're busy doing other things.
That's right. And interestingly,
not because they want to, because they have to. It's a job that may be an hour and a half away. They don't spend as much time with their children generally.
Right. But when they get with their children, you can still have a touch, and that's efficient. But this issue of work-life balance isn't just a human thing. You find it in rat mothers as well. So some rat mothers lick and groom their rat pups a lot, and some only a little bit. And the pups that are groomed only a little bit are more nervous when they grow up. They have higher stress hormone levels. They're less willing to explore new environments. They're less willing to try new foods. And you might think, well, like, why doesn't evolution just take care of this? This is bad. Why don't you just get rid of it? But it's the work-life balance issue. If you're a rat mother and you don't have a food source right near your nest, then you've got to roam far and wide to get that food, and you don't have as much time to lick and groom your pups. Likewise, if your pups are growing up in an environment where they're likely to get preyed upon, where they have to explore a lot for food, they're actually better served by being more stress reactive. In that environment, it's actually a good thing.
Explain that before we go.
So
why is that a good thing?
Well, so if you're a pup and you grew up in an environment where you're not preyed upon, mm-hmm. where you don't have to, there's not a great risk of getting snatched by a hawk or a snake or whatever,
right.
then you're well served by being low stress reactive. But if you're in an environment where you're about to be preyed upon constantly, it's actually better for you to be a high strung pup and be more attentive.
I guess. David Linden is our guest. David Linden is a professor of neuroscience at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine with us today to talk about his new book, Touch, very simple title, Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. You can join our conversation on Midday. If you have a question for David or an experience you want to relate about touch, 410-662-8780, toll-free long distance for the Midday Show in Baltimore, 866-661-9309, and our email address midday@wypr.org. Hey, welcome back. Dan Roderick's on Midday with David Linden visiting us from the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine today. He's got a new book out. The last time David was on the show was his book, The Compass of Pleasure, became a New York Times bestseller. Now, Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Hand, heart, and mind. The heart part we ought to get into a little bit here when we talk about emotions. There was something I mentioned in the beginning of the show in the introduction. An old friend of yours comes up, sees you in a bar room or at a restaurant, at work, and just gives you a slap on the shoulder or rubs your shoulder a little bit, say, how you doing? How you doing? You feel good, right? Mm-hmm. You feel good about that. Your boss comes up to you, especially a boss of the opposite sex in the workplace, and does that, and it doesn't feel so comfortable. So what can we say about touch in those two scenarios?
I think the important thing to realize is that our experience of touch, or any other sensation, is not just a result of the stimulus. It's also a result of the context. So let's imagine this to make it even simpler. You're with your sweetheart in a very loving, connected time, and you get a nice little touch down the arm. It feels really good. Now imagine that very same touch, the exact same pressure, the exact same velocity, the exact same place on your arm, that caress from the exact same person, but now in the middle of an argument. Ooh, boy, that doesn't feel the same way, right?
I want to snatch my arm away.
Exactly. Right? It's totally unwelcome. And it's not just that it feels the same, but then you think about it differently upon reflection. It actually feels different from the very first moment you have the sensation. And the reason for that is that the higher parts of your brain areas with names like the parietotemporal junction and the orbitofrontal cortex, are sending signals to the somatosensory cortex, the part of your brain that makes you feel touch, and is influencing them based on context. So one of my favorite cartoons has a man and a woman sitting in a car, and their man is driving, and the woman has a grocery bag on her lap. And the man says, oh, phew, what smells like farts in here? And the woman says, well, that's the expensive French cheese we just bought. And he says, oh, well, in that case, what smells so delicious in here? So,
right,
you know,
right,
our experience is totally dependent upon context and expectation.
Right. 410-662-8780. We welcome calls for David Linden in this hour as we explore the science of touch, talk some more about touch. Let's take a call, David. This is Steve out in Howard County in Ellicott City. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan. I have a question. Well, first, make a comment. I had a very severe stroke 7 years ago, and my left side is just about totally numb. But when I put my left hand is very sensitive to hot and cold, so I can still feel that very, you know, very much. So I think David mentioned earlier that the fingertips have different nerve endings that handle, that register hot and cold. So do those nerve endings go to a different part of my brain than the other nerve endings on my left side?
So the answer is yes, they do. And so presumably you have damage on the right side of your brain, which processes sensation from the left side of your body. And I'm not an MD and I don't diagnose patients, but what has happened is that you have a hole that or a lesion that is delimited such that it has spared the parts, just as you suspected, that process temperature information.
Here's a question that came in from Vince by email. Can David discuss the memory of touch? I touched on the word memory earlier. I know what something feels like strictly by the memory of having previously touched it. Or can I remember what a deceased family member's hand felt like, though the last time I touched their hands was many years ago when they were alive? That's interesting, because sometimes someone you knew, unless you have the photograph of them, you may not remember exactly what they looked like if it's been 30 years or 40 years, or what they smelled like, or the exact color of their hair. Now, the feeling of a hand, one hand or another, a father's hand, a mother's hand, is that something that stays with you, that you remember through touch?
Well, absolutely. All of our senses can contribute to memories. And what we now believe is that when you have an experience in the world, let's say, you know, you're with your parent as a child, and there's all these different senses coming in. You're hearing their voice. Maybe you're, you know, smelling their skin and touching their hand and all these different things that are happening. The different sensory aspects of those memories are stored in different parts of the cortex that process those information. So the vision part is stored in the visual cortex, and the auditory part is stored in the auditory cortex, etc. So certainly you can store touch memory just as you can store memory for all the other senses, and you can bind that touch memory together to form memory of episodes, of particular things that have happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking my father died 9 years ago, and I have very strong memories of the tickle of his mustache on my face when I would get a kiss as a small boy.
Right. I have a memory of my father, just for fun, you know, when he didn't shave or he had his 5 o'clock shadow rubbing his face up against ours just to scratch it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
You know? Also had a dream recently about an uncle, Uncle Gene, who died in 1986, 85. And we were down at the beach. He had a beach house on Cape Cod, and it was very vivid. All my cousins were there. I was younger. This was back when Uncle Gene was alive, and his voice sounded exactly the same. But I don't remember in that dream touching anything. And I wonder, people have some, you know, vivid dreams. I just had one.
Mm-hmm.
All the sights and sounds were the same as I remember them, but I don't remember the feel of his hand or feeling anything in a dream. Do people experience touch in dreams?
Well, the answer is yes, they do, but touch seems to take a back seat in dreams. So I think all of us have had some touch sensation in dreams. Certainly we can have sexual dreams and have sexual sensation as well.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, dreams are more skewed towards the visual than real life is. And if we know this both from people's detailed dream reports and also from experiments when people are in a brain scanning machine while they're dreaming, we see visual memory areas of the brain active to a much greater degree than we would see touch memory or even auditory memories, areas of the brain.
David Linden, our guest from the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, his latest book, again, is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Now, I've itched myself sitting here in the last few minutes. I don't know if you've noticed that. Have you noticed me itching my arm?
I have. Positively simian, yeah.
I just itched a spot on my chest through my sweater and my shirt. Mm. Okay. What is an itch? Do we know what an itch is?
Well, so that's a great question, because for years people have argued, is itch a completely distinct sensation? Is it utterly unique, or is it just a pattern of other sensations that are more fundamental? Is it like a little bit of pain and a little bit of light touch blended together? And, you know, biologists argued about this, philosophers argued about it, but now, for the very first time, thanks to my colleague Xinzhong Dong at Johns Hopkins University, we now know that there is at least one dedicated type of nerve ending just for itch that has a unique molecular signature. Now, the thing about itch is that it's very special, right? Itch doesn't just feel like weak pain. Pain doesn't compel scratching. Itching always compels scratching. And presumably, mm-hmm. our evolutionary story is that it's adaptive to prevent infestation by things like insects.
Right. Or mites or whatever.
That's right. And this is part of the reason why itch is so contagious. When you see someone scratching, seeing you scratch makes me want to scratch.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you think about it, if you live in a social group, if the person next to you is infested, then the chance that you're going to get infested soon is high as well. So it is adaptive for you to start scratching and seek out where you might be infested yourself.
Okay. So, but I'm not clear that if you've observed good hygiene, had a shower. Of course, you're wearing clothes. You don't know what's in the clothing, but, you know, what brings it on then?
Well, it turns out there's many different triggers for itch, some of them having to do with dry skin. So in the itch science world, they talk about histamine-mediated itch and histamine-independent itch. We've all heard of antihistamines that prevent inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems as if there are a bunch of different ways to trigger the itch sensation. And there's probably more than one kind of itch-transducing nerve ending. The exciting thing about identifying these molecularly is that it allows us to develop new therapies. You probably know right now, if you've gone out in your yard or gone hiking, gotten poison ivy, the kind of cream that you can get from the doctor isn't that good. It doesn't really relieve the itching very well. And it's, you know, you'll be up for nights.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we have molecular identification of an itch receptor, and we'll probably have the remaining ones identified, now that is going to allow us to make drugs like creams to rub on that are going to be much more effective anti-itch medicines.
Well, that's good to know. Thank you, David. Here's another question for you that goes back to some of the examples I cited or the questions I raised in the opening of the show. If I'm sitting here conducting an interview with you, my cup is empty. I started the day off with a nice warm cup of tea. That was in the previous hour of midday. Now my tea is cold, but I'm still feeling pretty good about you. I'm glad you're here. But you suggested that, or something is suggested by, a warm cup of coffee or tea in the hand when we are actually looking at somebody in terms of how we perceive or feel about that person.
That's right. You don't even have to look at them. You can even do it by reading a job resume. But no, it's true. This is the way the study
You'll actually get a warm feeling from a warm cup of coffee?
That's right. In a way, this is kind of a bug. Even incidental touch sensations can affect our rapidly formed impressions of other people. So if you're holding a warm cup of coffee while you're meeting someone for the first time or you're reading their resume for a job, you will rate them as warmer, more friendly, more trustworthy, more cooperative. Interestingly, you don't rate them as better in every way. You don't rate them as more serious about the job. You don't rate them as more competent, as smarter, only as warmer. Now, if you read their resume and instead of putting it on a normal clipboard, you put it on like a real heavy, like a clipboard that's like about the weight of an old school laptop, like 3 pounds, Then, amazingly, in that situation, you rate them as being more serious, literally having more gravitas.
Really?
Yeah, it's astonishing. If you're, there's another experiment where they had people watch some people interacting, and if they were holding smooth, rounded objects, they were more likely to rate the interaction as congenial, whereas if they were holding sharp-edged objects, they were more likely to rate the interaction as more adversarial. So even these incidental touch sensations influence us. And to me, that's very surprising.
You know, when we were talking about development, human development before, we didn't really talk about pain and learning that things are sharp, learning that things are hot. It doesn't take much to learn that, but it's all part of touch.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you don't have to learn it. It's a baby is born already
equipped.
Being wired up to know that pain is bad.
Right.
But, you know, you might think, it turns out that there are very rare genetic diseases where people can't feel pain at all. It's called congenital total insensitivity to pain. And you might think, wow, I wish I could get that, a life without pain. That would be so great. But the problem is that you need pain in order to have the reflexes that protect you. So people who can't feel pain, they unknowingly rub grit into their eyes. They swallow boiling liquids. They wear their shoes too tight, and they cut into their feet, and they get bacterial infections.
They wouldn't even know if they were injured.
They would not know if they were injured. In the book, I talk about a story about a young boy who jumps off a high roof in Lahore, Pakistan, to impress his friends. He gets up. He says, "I'm fine." He goes home, and he dies that night. And his parents don't know anything because he didn't complain, so they didn't know to take him to the doctor.
My God, he had that condition.
He had that condition. When asked, what is pain? He didn't really know. He knew how to like take a dive in soccer and mimic pain in order to draw a penalty for the opposing player, but he didn't really have any concept of what pain was. And as a consequence, most people who have this condition don't die in some dramatic way like this boy who jumped off the roof. Most of them die from a rather mundane thing like bacterial infections. But it's pretty hard to live past the age of 25 when you have this.
Wow. That's at one extreme with pain. The other extreme would be someone who's incredibly sensitive. Such a condition exists?
There is. It's called paroxysmal pain disorder. And these are actually two different mutations in the same gene. The gene is called SCN9A, and it's a gene that makes a protein that's important for sending electrical signals just in pain neurons and not in any other kind of neuron. So your other aspects of touch are fine. Moderate heat and cold and itch and light touch and caress, sexual sensation, they're all fine. It's only pain that's effective. If you have a mutation that turns it off, then you have the total insensitivity to pain. If you have a mutation that makes this neuron fire like a machine gun, in other words, fire bursts of activity when normally it would be silent or weakly active, then you have the horrible sensation of having totally random bouts of horrible pain. And people say this pain is terrible. Like the women who've given birth without anesthetic say that the bouts of pain are worse than giving birth without anesthetic.
Wow.
It's really serious. Wow. Nonetheless, amazingly, people who have this disorder can progress in their lives just fine. They can have families, they can have jobs, they can have full lives in spite of this horrible pain.
they can be empathetic to others, even if they can't, on the other side, if they can't feel pain.
Yes.
What about those people? Are they pretty well adjusted despite that?
Or? Well, so interestingly, the people who can't feel physical pain, you can still hurt their feelings. They still have emotional pain, and they still have empathy for the hurt feelings of others. But that brings up an interesting point. Is this construction, you hurt my feelings, I'm feeling emotional pain, I have heartbreak, you know, is this just metaphoric language? Is this like just like saying he's got a face like an unmade bed, right. You know? Or does it, is it something
real? It's a
real
question.
It's a real question. It sounds silly, but it's a real question. And what we now know is that if you put someone in a brain scanner and you hurt their feelings, say by having them read a "you're dumped" letter from their sweetheart, then the emotional pain area of the brain, a place called the posterior insula, becomes active in that point. So the metaphor is real, and the metaphor is constructed by overlapping patterns of brain activation.
So we should talk about the broken heart when we get back.
We should.
We'll take a short break here. We'll come right back. If you have a question for David Linden, please give us a ring. This is a good time to do it, 410-662-8780. Send in an email with a quick question to midday@wypr.org. Also, we're on Twitter @MiddayWYPR or Dan Rodericks. We can take a question that way. David Linden's latest book, published by Viking, is Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Listen to this email from Michelle, who says, as a caretaker for a parent with dementia, I learned that soft, slow, long touching helped my mother to focus when I was talking to her. I also modulated my voice when touching her, speaking in a slightly lower register.
Well, I don't know about the voice, but it's well known that that interpersonal touch is something that people tend to lose as we get older. So all of us, there's a biological thing and there's a social thing. So all of us lose touch-mediating nerve endings in our skin every year. We have the most of them when we're 20, then we lose about 1% a year every year. We don't notice it when we're young. We don't really notice it when we're middle-aged. By the time you're old, you've actually lost most of your nerve endings for everything: pain, itch, heat, cold, etc. And in addition to that, a lot of older folks, if they've lost their partner, if their kids don't live nearby, if they're in an institutional setting, don't get very much interpersonal touch. And we know that interpersonal touch, particularly in the elderly, reduces depression and anxiety. And among people with dementia, as was mentioned here,
by Michelle,
We know that interpersonal touch is one of the best ways to get people with dementia to focus and to be calm and to be happy. As a matter of fact, it's also good to touch a pet. Now, in many institutional settings, a cat or a dog is really nice, but you can't always have those in institutional settings. So there are some institutions now that are experimenting with a robotic baby harp seal named Paro to use in precisely this situation with elderly folks with dementia.
We were going to talk about the broken heart a little bit. So there's a metaphor that's been around forever. You think there's something to it?
Well, I think there is definitely something to it. I think there's something to the reason why feelings are called feelings. I mean, it may sound silly, but why are feelings feelings and not sightings or smellings? Why do we
right.
say when I'm emotionally affected, we say I'm touched?
Right.
When someone is emotionally clumsy, we call them tactless. Literally, they lack touch.
Mm-hmm.
And you might say, well, this is just a little trick with English within the last few years. But it turns out if you go back, this is in English, even in Old English, in the 12th century, they were already saying this. And if you go look across languages, it's not in every language, but it's in many languages all around the world. It's telling us something biological. Touch is an intrinsically emotional sense. If you look at what happens when all these different kinds of nerve endings conveying different kinds of touch information go to the brain, there's two different centers. There's one that's there for the facts of touch. How am I being touched? Where on my body? In what fashion? How strongly? There's a completely different area that's there for the emotional aspect of touch. it's what makes a caress feel good. It's what makes an orgasm feel good. It's what makes pain feel bad. And if there is damage to these emotional touch centers, then these sensations will no longer have any emotional relevance. And it is this emotional touch center that's also activated when you are heartbroken, when you are feeling emotional pain. This area, the posterior insula, is where the metaphor of the broken heart is created.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about as a common experience for a lot of people is the numbness or pins and needles feeling that can occur. I get it when I bang my elbow a certain way, maybe against a door frame, do something clunky and stupid. What is that?
Well, what that happens, it can happen a lot of time if you sleep funny and compressing a nerve. What happens
is that, sitting too long sometimes.
Right. When you compress a nerve for a while, you produce a section of that nerve that doesn't function and convey messages very effectively. Mm-hmm. And the pins and needles sensation is your brain trying to make sense out of messages that are garbled, that aren't really getting from, say, your foot to your brain, because at a place around your knee, you sat in a funny way and compressed that nerve. And as that compression resolves and you stretch and move around and your nerve function returns, then the pins and needles go away and your normal sensation returns to that foot. It also happens in people who suffer from diabetic neuropathy, that is to say, degeneration of the peripheral nerves as a consequence of long-term diabetes, often will get numb extremities. And usually it starts in the extremities and the fingers and toes and then gradually works its way more centrally.
What can you say about human comfort and touch, that in our evolution as we developed and societies developed and our environments developed, we made ourselves more comfortable, right? We don't sit on rocks as much as we used to. We don't sit on logs as much as we used to. We sit in comfortable chairs. We've created materials that are to our skin, touch and feel better, feel softer. We sleep in more comfortable beds with more comfortable bedding, uh-huh. Right? This is all part of humans trying to make themselves more comfortable, right? Don't live as rough as we used to.
Well, that's true. I think the thing we have to realize in an evolutionary time point is that this is something that's only happened in the last instant in evolutionary time. Human evolution is a very, very slow process. And cultures change very, very, very fast. And so it's only been in the last blink of an eye on an evolutionary time scale that we have things like, beds and overstuffed chairs.
Right. Okay. So maybe if you go sit on a rock, you feel comfortable. Actually, I like to do that. Go out in the woods, sit on a log or something like that, right?
Takes you
back, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
This is an email from Millie who says, I can't wear wool against my skin. A real problem when you have to wear suits. Why doesn't it bother other people?
That's a great question, and we don't entirely know. So some of it may have to do with conditions in the skin having to do with dryness and dermatologic issues. But the interesting thing is that there's a lot of variation in touch that we don't understand, for which we don't understand the genetic basis. Let me give you an example from a different sense, right? Some people like cilantro, and some people just can't stand cilantro. It tastes like soap. And we now know the people who hate cilantro all have a mutation in the very same odor receptor in the nose. The human nose has about 400 or so odor receptors, and there's one of them. If you got a mutation in that particular one, you're going to be a cilantro hater. Now, it may well be that there are similar mutations in some of the molecules that subserve different aspects of touch and might make you hate wool or have a high pain threshold or a low pain threshold, for example.
Okay, that could explain that. Okay.
And it could, but in truth, we know almost nothing about that. It has yet to be explored.
Well, speaking of the future, which I like to have you do a little bit more of, this research that goes on with regard to touch, it could lead to good things. You mentioned a couple. What else?
Well, so I think one of the most important things has to do with pain.
Understanding pain.
So right now, we have drugs that are very good at attenuating pain. Like morphine's a great drug for pain.
It's great.
But as you know, it's got lots of problems. It's addictive. It's euphoric. It constipates you. It's got all kinds of bad side effects. Now, recall that I said when I was talking about the mutations that can make you have paroxysmal pain or no pain, that there was a gene that was specific to the electrical function of pain neurons. It's not any other neurons. Well, that's wonderful news, because that's a magic bullet right there. If we can make drugs that target that specifically, then we can have a whole new class of anti-pain medications. Imagine, for example, going to the dentist and you get an injection of something that's better than xylocaine. With xylocaine, it doesn't just block pain, it blocks all the sensation. And it doesn't just block the sensory nerves, it blocks the motor nerves, so you can't actually move your mouth properly.
In there, yeah.
Right? Now imagine if instead, in that syringe, we had a drug that only blocked the pain neurons. It would be a much better topical anesthetic.
Let's take another call for David Linden. This is Larry in Tawnytown. Larry, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I have a quick comment and a question. My younger son was born with autism, and in his infancy and his early toddlerhood, he refused. He fought against being held and against being touched. Now, my wife very well held, forced holding him and caressing him and loving him. And actually, today, he's socially very well integrated. He saw some challenges with the autism. But it seemed like it was a magical change, just insisting that the human touch did happen. Hmm. Now, I do have a question with children, infants or toddlers. Is it feasible that they can be self-stimulating? They could touch their own arms or stuff like that, and cause and effect is similar to like a parent touching the arm? Or is there something specific about two different entities doing that act, if you know what I mean?
That's a great question. It turns out that, yes, self-touching, both for kids and adults, has some of the benefits of social touch, but it's not nearly good as being touched by someone else. But it turns out there's an explicitly biological reason for that. It's the same reason why we can't tickle ourselves, right?
Oh, I'm so glad you got to that.
So when you go to tickle yourself or you go to touch yourself in any way, your brain is sending messages to the muscles in your arm and your fingers to make the tickling sensation. But that message is being copied. And that message also goes to a part of the brain called the cerebellum, and from there it's turned into an inhibitory signal, which goes to the part of your brain where you feel the touch sensation, the tickle, and it damps it down. It makes it less strong. And so that's why you can't tickle yourself unless you have cerebellar damage, in which case then you can tickle yourself. Hmm. It's also the same reason why interpersonal touch is much better than self-touching for all of the socialization.
So if I understand, then the brain is just a little confused. Is that right?
Well, it's not that the brain is a little confused. It's adaptive. We want to pay attention to things that result from things on the outside world and pay less attention to the things that are generated from our own motions. So when you walk down the street, you're not thinking about, you're not attending to the way your clothes move against your body very much, because those motions aren't very important. But if you were standing still and then your clothes moved against your body in that same way, then you would attend to that very strongly, because that would indicate you're being groped or something, or you know, something's going on. We want to pay more attention to the outside world, and that's why we are hardwired to reduce our perception of self, of the sensory consequences of self-generated motion.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed this hour with you. I wish this happened more often, but you got to publish more books or just come by more often. It's a pleasure having you on the show again. David Linden from the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, his latest book is Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Viking is the publisher. His previous book was The Compass of Pleasure. Great having you on the show again, David. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yep, thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. We'll see you again tomorrow. Have a great afternoon.